how well suited our last speaker is to finish the conference, because and I'll just say something very briefly about his CV. He was a cabinet minister in the last Labour government. I was going to say perhaps the last Labour government, but I'm not allowed to make jokes of that kind. The last Labour government between 1997 and 2010. So throughout that period, the Right Honourable Jack Straw was a cabinet minister. Moreover, he held two of the great offices of state, Home Secretary and Foreign Secretary, which in their breadth of coverage covered off many of the subjects that we were teasing out, particularly in the last session, where we branched beyond defence into aspects of the impact of digital technology, for instance, on civil society and so on. So there could be no one better to conclude the conference than Jack Straw.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks very much, Richard, and ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for that introduction. I hope you take the same view at the end of my remarks. I've only been here, not for the whole of the conference, but since 3 o'clock. So if I'm repeating things that have already been said, I apologise, but I'll leave a bit of time at the end for questions and for those who wish to upbraid me for what I've said. I've been, since I was set this exam question by my friend and neighbour Michael Burley, NATO's next 10 years, I've been trying to give it obviously some thought, as we all have. And this, to make a statement of the blindingly obvious, but it's really important, not least against the background of the previous discussion, to bear in mind that NATO's future, in my judgment, depends almost exclusively on politics, not on relative military strength. I mean, yes, I thought what Greg Berkshire had to say and other colleagues on the platform was very interesting about whether we've got, we can match the nuclear potential, nuclear capability of Russia and China in specific areas, whether we've got exactly the right suite of missile technology. But it is incontrovertible, and everybody knows this, that NATO combined spends four times as much as China, and well over 10 times as much as Russia. If we don't have a military solution to what we, at the moment, to what we perceive as the military threats from Russia and China and maybe other actors, then within those budgets, there's no reason why that shifts in spending cannot be achieved over a relatively short period of time. The much bigger question is about politics. How, in the context of the United Kingdom and European countries, how do we continue to make the case for an alliance which is 70 years old and where the raison d'etre for the alliance going back to the late 40s and right through the 50s, 60s, 70s and the 80s has changed dramatically. Those of my generation and the next sort of half generation who are younger don't need any reminder about the history of how NATO came into being. But for those one generation below and now two generations younger than me, this is history. This is what granddads think about things. And then the question is, well, is there any point in trying to explain the history, given the fact that the context in which NATO is operating has changed dramatically? Well, I think there is a point, and it's to explain why this institution was established, what it achieved, and why, and then you move on from there, from that base, why it's still needed today. And I'm struck that although, you know, the end of the Second War is itself now 74 years ago, the beginning 80, that the evident demand for histories, for novels, for film and video about what happened in the Second World War continues unabated. And many of those are absorbed by young people as much as by older people. But what is not the case is that there's no parallel literature, videos, films, but popular culture about what happened immediately after the Second World War and how it was that the world, having been divided, united for the defeat of Hitler, separated itself so dramatically in the space of 3 or 4 years. So I think we need to do what we can to fill in those gaps. We need to offer more explanation, because it is relevant today to Russia's behavior, about how the Soviet Union under Stalin behaved immediately after the Second War. Yes, as part of a kind of deal, the West accepted Roosevelt, Truman, Churchill, that the Soviet Union should have free rein in what became the Eastern Bloc. But it's also worth pointing out that if Stalin had had his way, he would certainly have annexed a northern part of Iran. It took a lot of effort to get him to remove his troops, notwithstanding the fact that the explicit agreement for British Soviet occupation of Iran was that they would come out within a year. And, for example, that in Greece, the Soviets continued to sponsor what amounted to a civil war for some years after that, and continued to support what they saw were anti-colonial terrorism elsewhere across the world. And the reason that is relevant today is that although Russia is half the population of the Soviet Union, much diminished in strength, and doesn't have the satellite countries that it had until the collapse of communism. Some of the behaviors which we saw after the war are still there. I always have echoing in my brain when I think about Putin, a footnote in Simon Sebag Montefiore's biography of Stalin, just a tiny little footnote halfway through the book, which mentioned that Putin's grandfather was Joe Stalin's chef. I don't say therefore Putin has had transmitted Stalin's methods. He hasn't. But it's just, a thought about the connections there, which is worth contemplating. I think we also have to remind the next generation, the one after that, what NATO achieved. It did it with, yes, for sure, with others, with the example of European, Western European countries, and the phenomenal improvement from a standing start in their living standards and their freedoms after the Second War, which was not accidental, didn't necessarily have happened that way, compared with that, what was going on within the Soviet bloc. And NATO played a very important part in that, and so it has in one of the outstanding success stories in terms of nation building post the collapse of the Soviet bloc in the early 1990s, which is the creation of relatively democratic, in some cases very democratic, states across the old Eastern Bloc. Now, you can criticize what's going on, and I would do, what's going on in Hungary and in Poland, for example. But if you think how those countries might have turned out, if you think about how some countries, Belarus, Moldova have turned out, the fact that these countries are now more or less successfully operating most days Western democracies is a cause for celebration, but also a cause for reminding people that this didn't happen by accident, and NATO played a key part. Now, moving on to the sort of current day, the argument, that, as far as I'm concerned, which is persuasive for me about NATO, and I guess for most people in this room, is that if we, looking at the potential of threats, the possibility or the probability of these threats turning into reality is low, but what would happen if they did would be very severe. Looking at the possibility of these threats, are we better off to have the United States alongside us or back in isolationist mood, which is to some extent the default setting of the US, or certainly was during the 1920s and 1930s, and indeed part of the 1940s as well. My answer to that is, without any question, we need to have, we're better off with the United States alongside us, because of common interests, common civilization, and also it's a point I sometimes ask younger people if they're complaining about the US, and there's plenty to complain about the US, it's indeed, and I'm happy to bring out my own long list. But you ask people where they'd rather live, assuming language is not an issue, would they rather live in China? Would they rather live in Russia? Or would they rather live in the United States? And the answer is, of course, the United States. And if you ask actually quite a lot of people, say, leaders in authoritarian regimes, where they'd rather have their children educated, well, it turns out that they would rather have their children educated, say, in the United Kingdom or in the United States, notwithstanding the torrent of rhetoric against those two states, just as their children benefit from not only the education but the freedoms in those countries. We do have common interests to defend, and also just in terms of our own self-interest, given how much this country and Europe depends on American technology for our daily life, leave aside our military capability, it seems to me it would be insane for us gratuitously to push the United States away. Now, if we do have these common interests to defend and a self-interest, the question is, how then do we do that? Yes, of course, the circumstances in which NATO operates have changed. But in my view, there is no need to reinvent a transatlantic alliance, but just instead to honour and to strengthen and reform the way NATO operates. And I would, if I may, just pick up something that Richard Barron said, where he said, well, nothing, no, as it were, nothing is forever. Well, that's true up to a point, but you never know how long institutions, whether they're a national institution or international, may last. Some institutions last an astonishingly long time, and I reflect on the fact that the British Parliament has kept going without disruption for 331 years, despite the fact, for example, in the last, June 2016, to be precise, its resilience has been tested almost to destruction. Some institutions do just last because people need them. And there's no rule that says that just because an institution has reached 70, it's going to drop down dead over the next 10 years. It depends whether there is a case for it, and I think indeed there is. Now, of course, to deal with the kind of elephant in the room, people's view of NATO, and indeed to some extent people's view of the United States, is much at the moment affected through the lens of Mr. Donald Trump. For those of us who love the US and also want to stay close to it, This has been a tricky period for everybody. But on the other hand, although his diplomatic technique, if one can call it that, is unique and discombobulating to a great many, he's not been wrong about everything when it comes to NATO, and he's certainly not wrong, in my opinion, in cajoling those Western European states who have been ready to shelter behind the United States defense umbrella without paying their way, to cajole them into paying more. And if one or two of these states has a good case for keeping their contribution where it is, well, let them say so. But I say, in a sense, although Trump's rather very direct diplomacy is not mine, I think he's quite right to shame them. Where, of course, Trump, my view, was wholly wrong in at the same time as he's now saying that he honours NATO in and supports it, in not respecting any part of its approach when it came to this unilateral withdrawal of American troops from Syria, just like that, without any, as far as one can judge, serious understanding or consideration of the consequences of doing that, and no consultation with allies. If there is an alliance, then consultation has to be a two-way street. But Trump will not last forever. I don't know, I have no idea whether he's going to win the election this time next year, maybe some magic will happen amongst the Democrats. But I think if I was going to put some money on it, I think I'd put money on him winning this time next year, not losing. But he's going to, even if he does, he will only be there for another 4 years. And we need NATO and this alliance with the United States to last for a lot longer than that. Greg Melcher was, however, absolutely right to say that the NATO expansion that took place at the beginning of, or through the 1990s and into the beginning of this century, was led politically, which is, as it, in a sense, as it should be, but with little strategic or military thinking running in parallel with that, and nor, to some extent, with a great deal of thought about what the impact would be on Russia, although I think we, on the whole, we made the right decisions about which new Eastern European nations to bring into NATO. Now, just dealing with Russia, I mean, it's an obvious point that we all want good relations with Russia. We prefer there to be a good dialogue with Russia. And it is worth bearing in mind, as far as the UK government is concerned, that at the beginning, shortly after Putin took over, a big effort was made, for example, by the Blair government to improve relations, and they did improve for a while. But I'm afraid Russia rather quickly reverted to type after that. That's the truth. There wasn't anything we did particularly, but which they did, and it's really gone. Their approach to the West, to NATO, has deteriorated since then. And what's, I think, really important, everybody in this room understands this, but for example, wider audience outside with whom we're trying to make a case for NATO, and also for saying that an immediate threat is the one from Russia, need to understand is that Russia is not remotely a normal democracy. It's not normal, nor is it a democracy. However reasonably it started, the Putin period started, it's now descended into being it's an oligarchic security elite, where the imperative of those running Russia today is to stay in power and protect their wealth, and to ensure, especially, that when and if they lose power, they don't end up either exiled or in prison. And that changes their metrics of operation very differently. the at least I was going to say there is a silver lining in their takeover of eastern Ukraine and the Crimea, along with the assassinations of this Georgian dissident in Berlin and the attempted poisoning in Salisbury, which is that we don't have to appeal to, as it were, ancient history. We can actually point to what has happened in recent years. And the incredible provocative nature of these actions and the fact that they show no subscription to any principles of international relations of which I can think. Nonetheless, there is a significant problem in some European countries, less so here, but I think it's under the surface, where if you poll publics and ask them what they think relatively of the US or of Russia, it's either even Stevens or Russia slightly better in these numbers than the United States. And that was true in Germany in a recent poll. It took place before this assassination. It may be that this assassination will shift opinion a bit, because, but again, I bet if you poll Germans and ask them where they'd rather live, they wouldn't put Russia at the top of their list. But that is a problem. Now, I wanted to say to talk about one country which is really important in terms of NATO's cohesion, which certainly wasn't mentioned in the two sessions that I heard, but maybe was mentioned before, and that's Turkey. It was a critical part of the kind of architecture of NATO when it was established. NATO, America and the rest of the West bit their tongue about the fact that it was a pretty authoritarian state, because they thought it was rather more important for it to be an authoritarian state on the side of the West than to drift into any kind of ambit within the of Russian influence. I happen to say, to declare an interest here, I know quite a lot about, or at least I think I know quite a lot about Turkey, because I've been co-chairman of the British Turkish Forum for the last 9 years, and got to know it very well before that. And I'm not here to defend President Erdogan. He has, again, differently but parallels here, starting from a rather good base of a democratic election in late 2002, finally assuming power in 2003, after he'd had to get the Constitutional Court to quash a conviction, which was of a conviction for uttering a hymn, a banned hymn, and which had banned him from public office. Anyway, he took over in 2003, and he my view, started very well. And it was, it's a great paradox here. It was the Erdogan Gül administration which brought the application of Turkey for EU membership out of the deep freeze and started pursuing it very actively. And the EU agreed to that in October 2005. And a number of people in his party, the more moderate people, said to me that they saw the negotiations, lengthy negotiations, which they're anticipating over maybe 15, 20 year period, but they wanted them to carry on, as a way in which Turkey could negotiate with itself in order to improve its own internal governance and rights. And the tragedy is that, not partly because the EU made this historic, catastrophic error of allowing a divided Cyprus, or one part of a divided Cyprus, to come into the European Union in 2004, and I'm afraid I was party to that. It gave the Greek Cypriots a chance to block progress on Turkey's accession, aided and abetted, I'm afraid, by Nicolas Sarkozy when he was president, in very sharp distinction from the approach taken by his predecessor, Jacques Chirac, and also assisted by Angela Merkel, again in sharp contrast to the attitude taken by Gerhard Schröder. And although Turkey is not in a position now to be brought into membership, what is, without any question, the case that Turkey has been treated more harshly and with more hurdles in its way than, for example, Romania or Bulgaria were treated. Bulgaria and Romania weren't really ready to become members. They didn't tick all the boxes, and they still don't. It's the truth. But they were brought into the European Union on the grounds that it's better to have them in the tent than outside. They could easily fall much further within the Russian ambit, and that if they were inside the tent, much greater work could be done to improve things like human rights and their level of democracy. That hasn't happened with Turkey, and the result has been that they've been pushed away from Europe. Now, countries, particularly countries the size of Turkey, have a dynamic position. They're not just going to say, well, okay, that's fine, we'll carry on asking. And Erdogan, as it were, speaks to a very strongly nationalist sentiment amongst many, many Turks. So this has pushed them away. Now, it requires some considerable thought and effort, particularly by European Union leaders, as to how to pull them back. Erdogan's not going to be there forever. He's the one thing that does take place, roughly speaking, in Turkey, notwithstanding other aspects of the way Erdogan runs the country, is that there are relatively free elections, certainly ones that there be, and there will be again. If we want Turkey to continue to be an active and supportive member of the NATO alliance, and we don't want to lose it, then more effort's got to be made by the EU, by the UK, and indeed in other ways by the US, to get Turkey back. I bet I'm not here again to justify their purchase of the SS-400, which seems to me to be an error for all sorts of reasons. But if you look at it from their point of view, you can see why they made that decision. I'm almost over time. I'm just going to say this about China. I understand what's said about China and the potential threat it poses, particularly to US interests in the Pacific and to the interests of many other states who don't want to be under China's axis within the Eastern Pacific area. I, however, would be very reluctant to see NATO expanded from its current potential theatre. All that went wide when it came to the 9/11 Article 5 decision and the involvement of many NATO states in Afghanistan. But if it was expanded to take in threats from China, then it's really turning it into a kind of universal world policeman. And I think at that point, the strains within it could lead it to fall apart. So it's better to recognize the limits of its geographical spread as well as its political spread. China is, just across it, as is Russia, a neighbor of the United States. We often, in Europe, forget that the United States and Russia are almost joining on the Bering Sea, but across the Pacific Ocean, it is a neighbor. So their strategic interests in China are bound to be very different from ours. It doesn't mean we should ignore them, but it does mean that I don't think that should be part of NATO's terms of reference. So to come to a conclusion, I think NATO does have a future for the next 10 years. There's no reason why, with a bit of thought and imagination within countries and from NATO political leaders, it shouldn't have a future for 20 or 30 years' time. But it comes down, in my view, above all, to making the case with skeptical publics about why you need this alliance in the changing circumstances of what's about to be the third decade of the 21st century. Thank you very much indeed.